From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The 2018 Farm Bill has made it through Congress and now goes to President Trump.
It looks like the Farm Bill is in very, very good shape. So we'll get the Farm Bill. Got to take care of the farmers.
Trump is expected to sign the five-year, 800-page, $867 billion bill. It's expansive legislation that pays for food stamps, crop insurance, it expands commodity subsidies, and even legalizes industrial hemp by removing it from the Controlled Substances Act, potentially opening up a $20 billion industry. This version of the bill has strong bipartisan support, but it took a fight to get there. And there's still disagreement over whether that $860 billion is being put to the best use. This hour on Point, a deep dive into the 2018 Farm Bill. And you can join us. Do you stand to gain from this new Farm Bill, this new version of it? Are you concerned about SNAP benefits or actually relieved about what didn't get changed? What about crop insurance in an era of climate change and the ever-looming threat of a trade war between the U.S. and China? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, a bit later this hour, we will also talk with two outgoing Democratic House members about why they're leaving Congress and their advice for incoming legislators. But first, let's take that deep dive into the Farm Bill. And joining us from Washington is Catherine Boudreau. She's food and agriculture reporter for Politico. She's extensively covered the 2018 Farm Bill. Catherine, welcome back to On Point.
Hi.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let me just start with food stamps and SNAP benefits, because that was the source of a lot of political disagreement in various versions of this bill. Where did we land with food stamps?
Right. This was one of the biggest hurdles that agricultural lawmakers had to clear to reach an agreement. It took months of negotiations. And essentially where they landed was not too different from current law. So House Republicans wanted to impose stricter work requirements on between 5 and 7 million adults participating in the food stamp program. But those did not go through. Those are not in the final bill. Also, they wanted to tighten categorical or just eligibility for the program in general. And those provisions didn't make it through. Basically, what we're left with is some investment in work and training programs, which were included in the Senate bill. So people won't be, you know, losing eligibility or getting their benefits
slashed. So, I mean, the House Republicans and Paul Ryan's attempts to put more work requirements on food stamps, as you said, was very politically contentious. I mean, we're talking about a program that helps nearly 40 million low-income Americans buy their groceries every month. But even though there are very few sort of big changes being made to the program, I just want to play a little bit of tape of what Paul Ryan said just last week when he was urging lawmakers to pass the bill. And here's what he said.
This bill strengthens work requirements and boosts work supports so that more people are spurred toward opportunities.
So, Catherine, if you just said that it doesn't actually strengthen work requirements at all, why is that the House Speaker saying this?
Yeah, we actually wrote a story about this, that we consider that message to be a little misleading, because just the far-reaching proposal that House Republicans put forth, really none of that ended up in the bill. I mean, there are, as I said before, investments in work and training programs. And also, I think that down the pike, the Agriculture Department will propose a rule that will potentially limit states' ability to waive the work requirements already on the books for a certain population of people. But that's separate from the Farm Bill.
I see. So, but as of this point in time, when Paul Ryan says the bill strengthens work requirements, that's just not true.
I think that they consider these investments in work and training potentially a win. But like I said, I think it's just misleading to say, because they didn't get a win, necessarily a win.
I've just hung up on the word requirements, I guess. But that's politics. OK, so we just covered sort of the changes to the SNAP program, and that being one of the biggest hangups to get the bill across the finish line in Congress. Let's talk about subsidies here, because this is another contentious point. Does the bill expand farm subsidies, and if so, to whom?
Right. So there are two different forms of farm subsidies. So it does expand what is known as commodity subsidies. So these are paid to farmers and when the crop prices or their revenue drops below certain levels. And those will actually be expanded by about $1 billion over a decade. But crop insurance is different. I mean, taxpayers subsidize about 60% of farmers' premiums when they go to buy crop insurance. And that program is largely staying as is, and it costs about $9 billion a year.
Okay. So we're going to come back to some more details on subsidies in a minute because it's, you know, a major part of this bill. But I want to talk briefly about a very new thing that's in this 2018 Farm Bill, and that has to do with legalizing hemp. And it was something that was actually championed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And he said on the Senate floor last week that the Farm Bill legalizes hemp as an agricultural commodity and removes it from the controlled substances list.
It also allows hemp researchers to apply for competitive federal grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and made hemp eligible for crop insurance. Together, these features will encourage new opportunities for struggling farmers and their families, new products for use in construction, healthcare, and manufacturing, and new jobs in a broad range of fields.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Catherine Boudreau, why is it that Senator McConnell was so excited wanted to put legalize hemp here? I mean, I think I remember in your reporting that he even put himself on a key committee to be sure that this happened.
Yes. So this has been a priority of his for a number of years, and he considers it a potential economic boon for Kentucky, rural Kentucky, you know, farmers who formerly grew tobacco, for instance, or are looking for a more lucrative crop to grow during a time of low commodity prices right now. So that's definitely why he's been kind of passionate about this, about legalizing it.
Okay. And so just to be clear, hemp is the marijuana plant, but without the THC in it.
Exactly. Right.
All right. So that's why that seems more politically feasible to remove from the Controlled Substances Act. Okay. So on that point, I actually want to turn briefly to someone that this hemp, this piece of the legislation that deals with hemp is going to benefit. Chad Wilson joins us now from Cave City, Kentucky. He's an industrial hemp grower and owner of Sacred Seed Farm. He's co-owner of the Louisville-based business Green Remedy, which extracts CBD oil from hemp. Chad Wilson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. Appreciate you having me and giving me the opportunity to discuss industrial hemp today. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. So tell us, how much of an impact will the legalization of hemp have on your business?
Oh, it'll be huge. You know, we've been struggling since the passing of the first Farm Bill, and that allowed us the research to do so. As we've, you know, it appears, you know, as you're in the industry, it appears you're fighting. We were fighting our own government to build an industry. So now that education is coming and across not just, you know, our legislators, but across our society and our citizens, the understanding that hemp is different than marijuana. So this is going to be actually huge for us in many ways, having access to crop insurance, hopefully having access to make business and interstate commerce easier for us. Mm-hmm. It's going to be huge for us as we try to develop and build this industry and create jobs across America.
Yeah, I hear you. So access to capital and, as you said, interstate mm-hmm. commerce as well.
And
what about insurance? Were you able to get crop insurance for your hemp plants beforehand?
Unfortunately, no, we weren't. And I became a product of the very thing that we needed last year. I planted my crops according to the weather, like we always do. And unfortunately, the weatherman was wrong. And I lost hemp seeds. High CBD hemp seeds are quite expensive right now. And I lost quite a bit of money, income off the farm due to weather washing me out. And what was ironic, it was the very day that I spoke with another TV host about why we needed Farm Bill, and we planted, and then that night I became the very thing that I needed. Hmm. I had all of my seeds wash out in the field, and it hurt us last year.
Yeah.
Bad.
So let me ask kind of a basic question here, just because I'm wondering if a lot of listeners might be curious about the same thing. Before this Farm Bill, which removes hemp from the Controlled Substances Act, I mean, was even growing hemp legal? Is what you were doing legal beforehand?
Yeah, well, yes. And I mean, and that's the thing. It kind of existed, you know, the congressional law and the Farm Bill held us in place, but we were in direct conflict with the federal government and the laws of the land there.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we're doing is basically through education and grassroots movement, we have educated the people and the legislators, and now there's this clear understanding. And then our legislators stood up and said, hey, we need to define this different. It's really insane that we was the only developed country that was not growing industrial hemp, yet we were importing billions of dollars of industrial hemp to be sold in the United States.
Huh.
So it just doesn't make any sense when our farmers could be putting this magnificent crop in the ground, healing the lands, and creating good jobs, good-paying jobs and income for our farms.
Well, one last question for you, Chad Wilson. How much of a difference is it going to make across Kentucky, for example? Because are there other crops that are sort of falling in popularity that Kentucky farmers used to rely on that hemp could replace?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as we've seen, and all farmers know, corn and soybeans prices, you know, up and down and have dropped over the years. Tobacco is nearly gone in Kentucky. And that's the problem that we have. What can our farmers do? And the milk industry is in desperate shape as well. And that's a big part of where I live here in Kentucky. That's, you know, major income. So, you know, just having this opportunity and having these tobacco farmers, the equipment that they use and everything that they use is a direct replacement. So I can easily teach and train a tobacco farmer how to produce high CBD industrial hemp without a lot of retooling. So it just makes a logical step. And then we can use this also to supplement our dairy farms so they're not worrying about losing their farms, because like I said, here in Kentucky, we lose 3 farm families a month because they can't pay their bills.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we have to recognize the value of the farm.
Well, Chad Wilson, industrial hemp grower and owner of Sacred Seed Farm in Cave City, Kentucky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Magna. Y'all have a wonderful day, and thank you for the discussion.
Likewise. Thanks so much. And by the way, listeners, last month we did a terrific hour-long conversation about CBD, as Chad Wilson referenced. That's one of the chemical compounds in hemp. Go to onpointradio.org to listen back at that hour and why CBD is growing in popularity. Catherine Boudreau, food and agriculture reporter with Politico. Stand by here for just a second because we've got to take a quick break. We're talking about what's in the 2018 Farm Bill and who benefits and who doesn't. And we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the 2018 Farm Bill. It's passed through Congress and now awaits President Donald Trump's signature. He is expected to sign the bill this week. It's an $867 billion 5-year bill that expands subsidies and deals with the nation's food stamp program as well. We heard in the last segment how it would seek to legalize hemp in the United States. Would love to hear your thoughts on the Farm Bill and whether or not it affects you. Catherine Boudreau is with us. She's food and agriculture reporter for Politico. And Catherine, I wanted to play a little bit of tape because I want to explore the issue of the subsidies with you a bit more, because it did not get unanimous support at all. Here's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. He's on the Senate Committee for Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. Obviously, he represents Iowa as well. And he told WOI Television in Des Moines last week that he voted against the Farm Bill, and here's why.
We shouldn't be subsidizing big farmers to get bigger, and that's what we're doing, and cutting out beginning in younger farmers getting started. So I voted against it on that narrow reason, but a very important reason to me.
Catherine Boudreau, so tell us a little bit more about what the senator's talking about here, about subsidizing big farmers to get bigger. What does he mean?
Right. So Senator Chuck Grassley has for a long time tried to rein in, I guess, eligibility for commodity subsidies on farms, the number of people on a farm who can qualify for subsidies. Basically, everyone who's receiving payments from these farm programs has to be, quote unquote, actively engaged. This is a USDA definition. And Senator Chuck Grassley thinks that's too loose, and it allows non-farmers, people who aren't really lifting a finger and doing the work, to receive upwards of $125,000 a year. That's the limit per person.
Okay, so can you clarify that a little bit? Because I'm seeing here that what we're talking about is it's possible now for nephews, nieces, and first cousins who may not even be working on the farm at all to qualify for these subsidies?
They technically still have to meet this definition. And there's really a lot of debate about whether this definition of actively engaged is strict enough. And it's just, you know, they tried to, you know, strengthen the definition in the last farm bill. And that's something that Senator Chuck Grassley was working on. But essentially, they exempted family farms from the more strict definition. And that means that, you know, most of these family farms are, most of the family farms in this country, most of the farms in this country are family farms. So they weren't subject to the stricter, definition.
Okay. Forgive me for being a little confused, but,
how can I clarify? Yeah. I mean, it's highly technical because this Senator Chuck Grassley is focusing in on a very narrow part of how people qualify for subsidies. But that's been a long crusade of his.
Okay. I guess I'm relying on your expertise. You're the person who's gone through every page of this bill here. But what I'm seeing in news reports, people keep pointing at this, that the final bill includes this House proposal that would allow more distant relatives to qualify for commodity subsidies. Does that have to do – I mean, is that with – which sort
right.
of what
yes.
is that?
So, if you're a farm owner, and you have a cousin, niece, or nephew working on the farm, I mean, they now will be considered a family member and be eligible. But again, they have to meet this definition that USDA enforces, and there's a lot of debate about whether that is strict enough.
Okay, and then in addition to that, there was a Senate attempt to limit the payments to the wealthier producers, as you were talking about before, but that is not in the bill. Is that what Senator Grassley was objecting to?
Yes, he also takes issue with the current limit. The income limit is $900,000 a year. So if you're earning above that, you do not qualify for commodity subsidies. The Senate wanted to lower that to $700,000, but that ultimately was stripped from the bill.
I see. Okay. So, Catherine, hang on here for a second because I want to turn to Caroline Kitchens. She's director of federal government affairs at the conservative think tank, the R Street Institute, where she focuses on agriculture issues. She joins us from Washington. Caroline Kitchens, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
So thank you for bearing with us as I tried to sort of understand with some more clarity the issue of these subsidies here. But let's start there. I mean, what's your view on where this farm bill has landed? Do you like the subsidies you see or not?
I do not like the subsidies. I think overall, while the bill may be a good deal for hemp farmers to some degree, and there are some very minor wins in it, on the whole, it's a bad deal for taxpayers. And really, it's a bad deal for anyone who believes that farm supports should look more like a safety net and not like a way to boost the incomes of large corporate agribusinesses. So in many ways, this bill is not only a missed opportunity to enact much-needed reforms, but it's actually worse than the status quo because of the new loopholes that Catherine was explaining.
Okay, so worse than the status quo. So tell us then, what do you think it's costing taxpayers?
Well, it's really hard to say. Obviously, the CBO estimates that the bill will cost $867 billion. In the past, farm bills have been very hard to predict. The commodity support programs have come in more than double what they were projected to during the last farm bill. So it's likely that the cost to taxpayers will be even higher than anticipated just because of the unpredictable nature of the farm economy.
Yeah. So, you know, I think let's talk a little bit more about what the reality of the farm economy is in the United States, right? Right now, because as Catherine was saying earlier, that most of the farms in America are still family-owned farms. But I hear you, Caroline, objecting to taxpayer subsidies going to large agribusiness here. So help us tease out, like, what's the reality?
Sure. So when Catherine explains family-owned farms, that's a definition within USDA, and that doesn't necessarily mean a small farm. So a family-owned farm is just the way that an agribusiness or a farm chooses to organize itself. And we know from the Government Accountability Office that there's one family-owned farm that designates 25 managers. So family-owned doesn't necessarily mean the small farms that you think of.
I see. So just like in other sectors where a company can still be family owned but be a billion-dollar business, for example.
Exactly.
Okay. So then ideally, I mean, if you think that this new bill is worse than the status quo from the old farm bill, what are the changes that you would propose?
Well, I think As an absolute minimum, Senator Grassley's amendment should have gotten in the final text. That's a very common sense idea. If we can't agree that people who don't actively live or work on a farm can't get subsidies, then I don't know how we're ever going to tackle the deficit. Beyond that, I would have liked to have seen the Senate's language that reduces the AGI limit from 900,000 to 700,000 make it in. And beyond that, there was really a whole slew of common sense reform amendments proposed to both the crop insurance and commodity titles. But ultimately, very few of those votes got a chance to see a vote.
Yeah. So Catherine Boudreau, but this issue of people who may not even live or work on a farm being qualified for subsidies, how did that even get through to begin with?
Right. So, I mean, to qualify for subsidies, you have to prove to USDA that you are contributing like land and capital and, you know, just a significant management of this operation. And like I said earlier, there's just a lot of debate about whether that is a strict enough definition, whether it's really being enforced. But there's just so that debate has been continually being had over multiple farm bills. And it just wasn't up for discussion this time, really. And I think that's in large part due to low commodity prices. Agriculture lawmakers really didn't have the appetite to take up this debate about how to tighten limits on farm subsidies.
Okay, so this issue about the current low commodity prices definitely was on the minds of a lot of lawmakers. So I want to play a little bit of tape here from Minnesota Democratic Congressman Colin Peterson. He's the ranking member and likely next chair of the House Agriculture Committee. He voted for the farm bill, but he told Minnesota Public Radio earlier this month that he's not sure if the legislation will even help farmers enough when it comes to current low commodity prices and U.S. Trade disputes.
Given what we're facing right now with the price situation and with the tariffs, I am worried that this bill is not going to be good enough to get us through what we're facing.
Carolyn Kitchens, let me turn to you on that, because I think a lot of lawmakers have been saying this, that farmers are facing such low prices right now that they do need assistance and support from the federal government.
Right, Meghna. It's absolutely true that there are farmers who are struggling. But this is something, honestly, I agree with Colin Peterson on. This bill is not enough to help farmers, because what we need to help farmers is better trade policies and ending the tariffs that are hurting farmers across the country. So the answer to that is not doubling down on this bad subsidy policy for another 5 years. It's enacting better trade policy and giving farmers more access to markets abroad.
Okay. But just yesterday, though, the president announced a second round of trade relief for farmers and ranchers who are being affected by retaliatory tariffs. And I think that brings the total direct payments to farmers to $9.6 billion. But I guess three quarters of that is going to soybean farmers here. So it sounds like you would be looking towards the president for a better solution in terms of, you know, the trade policy he's enacting with, say, China.
Yeah, absolutely. I think farmers have been the hardest hit by the trade war with China, and this farm bill is not going to help that problem. These direct payments may provide a Band-Aid, or I like to think of it as hush money to get farmers to keep their mouth shut about their lack of markets. But in the end, it's not going to help them.
Yeah. Well, let's get some callers here. Let's turn to Lewis, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Lewis, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi. I clearly, in listening to the discussion, there's a lot of things that could have gone into the farm bill. But in the current political climate, just getting a massive bill out like this is an accomplishment. And I would like to commend Senator Pat Roberts, the Senate chairman of the Agriculture Committee. I think in the Senate, you know, as I say, there are show horses and there are workhorses. And I think Senator Roberts is a workhorse. Mm. And I think this bill at least provides some stability moving forward. Had they not been able to get the bill through, it would have been even worse. So, you know, which I don't hear Senator Roberts mentioned often, but I think he deserves some praise.
Okay. Well, Lewis, thank you so much for your call. Let's turn to Neillsville, Wisconsin, where Kyle is calling. Kyle, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm calling from Clark County in Wisconsin. We're a major dairy county in a major dairy state. Y'all have already been talking about subsidies in relation to farm size. I'm hoping the guests could focus briefly on the dairy industry. I have two questions. First, I'm wondering what the impacts might be from the 2018 Farm Bill on the dairy industry nationwide, whether that's price support, subsidies, changes to insurance schemes, et cetera. And number two, if there are any provisions in this Farm Bill that you think might either strengthen or diminish the standing of smaller family-run dairy farms.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for your call. Catherine Boudreau, do you have an answer for Kyle?
Yeah, I do, actually. So the farm bill that the president is on track to sign, actually, I think this week, it does make it it makes it less expensive for dairy farmers to purchase an insurance program in the farm bill. And also have a higher level of coverage. So they'd made some significant investment in the dairy safety net, as they call it. And also this builds on what Congress already had done earlier this year in a budget agreement. Basically, they made an $800 million investment over a decade in this dairy insurance program. It's called the Margin Protection Program. So lawmakers have spent the last year really trying to boost that safety net because basically that program didn't pay out any money last year. And then due to the changes that have already been enacted, the USDA announced yesterday that about $250 million had been paid out, which is a significant jump from the previous year. And I think that's only going to grow because, again, once the president signs the farm bill, some of these other improvements are going to be enacted.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Caroline Kitchens, I wanted to turn back to you briefly and see if you had any thoughts about the dairy industry, because actually we had a couple of callers who wanted to ask about this, thinking that there are certain industries in agriculture industries in the United States that are truly hurting, that they feel aren't getting enough subsidy support.
Sure. Our biggest issue with the farm support programs rests in the corporate welfare that's inherent. And I think the dairy industry has much less of that than some of the very large-scale farms, primarily corn, soybean farms, that really benefit from these loopholes. So I don't focus as much on the dairy provisions, but I have no problem compared to the other subsidies with the fixes that have been made to the MPP.
I see. So I'm just curious, big picture here, is part of your concern about this new farm bill that once we start adding groups or expanding the reach of subsidies, that it's harder to pull them back in future versions of the bill?
Absolutely. I think we've seen that over and over in public policy. As new groups start to see benefits, it becomes harder to take them away. And really, this is the first bill in, I would say, decades that doesn't continue this general progression of tightening subsidies and targeting them towards those who most need them. So I worry that this bill is a step backwards in the ongoing effort to tighten payments and make sure that taxpayers' investments are going to people who truly need assistance.
Yeah. Well, Catherine Boudreau, then, I mean, politically speaking, though, it received bipartisan support. The president seems to be signaling that he's happy with this bill and will sign it. Does that take the heat off of the concerns, or the heat off the president, I should say, regarding all the concerns that we've been talking about, that some of the things that are truly hurting farmers right now are, tariffs and trade wars?
You know, I think, as Caroline mentioned earlier, this is the trade mitigation package, as they call it, the trade aid, is designed to kind of put a Band-Aid on the current problem. But, I mean, this is going to be a long-term problem because the trade dispute with China, there's not really an end in sight right now. I mean, there was a truce kind of reached at the G20 summit just a few weeks ago, but that doesn't necessarily mean there's a deal in hand. And of course, we've seen the president be very willing to ramp up tariffs if he doesn't like where the negotiations are headed. Currently, Mexico and Canada still have tariffs on a lot of U.S. agricultural exports. So right now, the problem just isn't being resolved. And again, this is a one-time trade aid package. So who knows, maybe there has been talks in Congress about potentially doing some additional money beyond the already $11 billion that the Trump administration has now been being sent to farmers and ranchers.
Yeah. Well, Caroline Kitchens, we've just got a minute left to go here. I mean, what would you like to see, or what do you see in sort of next steps regarding the U.S. agriculture business and, you know, how the federal government aids or doesn't aid farmers? What would you like to see happen?
Sure. So I think, as we've discussed, in the immediate term, we need to see better trade policy. Farmers need more access to markets. And unfortunately, we just locked in a farm bill for the next 5 years, which is why I think it's a real shame that it was rushed through without a lot of reform. But in the longer term, I think it's really important that we start to tailor our farm safety net to exclude the largest, wealthiest agribusinesses who can afford to manage risk on their own and to target the funds towards those who really need assistance. So in the long term, I would like to see some more market forces injected into the agriculture economy, and I believe that will ultimately allow the smaller and middle-sized farmers to thrive.
Well, Caroline Kitchens, director of the federal Government Affairs at the conservative think tank, the R Street Institute, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna.
And Catherine Boudreau, food and agriculture reporter for Politico. We've got links to Catherine's reporting at onpointradio.org. Catherine, thank you so very much for walking us through this big and complicated bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, when we come back, we're going to talk to two outgoing members of Congress about how Washington's changed and how they've changed over the course of their terms and their advice for incoming legislators. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In less than a month, Democrats will take the majority in the House for the first time since 2011. That means a divided Congress for the first time in the Trump administration and in a very politically polarized environment. So we're going to talk to two Democrats who won't be part of the new House majority. And you can join the conversation. What would you ask two departing lawmakers about what Washington has become? And what do you want from the new Congress when it convenes in January? Follow us on Twitter or comment on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us from Chicago, Illinois, is Democratic Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He represented Illinois' 4th congressional district since 1993, which includes portions of Chicago and its western suburbs. He announced last year he would retire from Congress and not run for re-election in 2018. Congressman Gutierrez, welcome to On Point.
A pleasure to be with you.
Also with us from Dover, New Hampshire, is Democratic Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. She represented New Hampshire's 1st congressional district off and on since 2007. It's definitely a swing district, losing and winning back her seat twice in that span. The district includes Manchester, Portsmouth, and much of the eastern half of New Hampshire. Congresswoman Shea Porter, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have both of you. I, first of all, actually want to play a couple of bits of tape from the other half of Congress, from the Senate, just to sort of give us a sense as to what some outgoing senators are saying. And I want to get your reflections on that. So first of all, here is Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona during his farewell speech to the Senate on Thursday.
Let us recognize from this place here today that the shadow of tyranny is once again enveloping parts of the globe. And let us recognize, as authoritarianism reasserts itself in country after country, that we are by no means immune.
That's Republican Senator Jeff Flake on his farewell speech on Thursday. During her farewell address on that same day, Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill said that she thinks the U.S. Senate is no longer the world's greatest deliberative body.
I'd be lying if I didn't say I was worried about this place. It just doesn't work as well as it used to. The Senate has been so enjoyable for me, but I must admit it puts the fun in dysfunction. Peter Morgan, an author, said, "No family is complete without an embarrassing uncle." We have too many embarrassing uncles in the United States Senate.
That's Senator Claire McCaskill on Thursday. Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, let me turn to you first. I suppose I was just taken by the frankness which with these outgoing senators were speaking. Do you have the same set of concerns about, let's say, those embarrassing uncles in your chamber in the House?
Absolutely. And I think their voices have grown stronger and louder in this last session, but we certainly have seen this since the 2010 election, where we had some of the impact of the Tea Party with the representatives there that were really, you know, pretty far out. And I don't need to repeat all of the speeches on the floor, but many of them got coverage and deserved that coverage. So I am concerned about the fact that we're not running very well, that we don't look good. We look crazy at times, and I understand why people think that. But I also want to reassure your listeners that there's a lot of really good, solid people who are paying close attention. They're in Congress, and they are concerned about the growth of the authoritarianism, and they are concerned about the tone, and they are concerned about the fact that we're not getting the work done. And so I remain optimistic.
You remain optimistic. So do you have the same tenor or kind of optimism that you had when you first became a member of Congress?
Well, let me say it was never easy because you mentioned the swing district. This district is 35% Republican, 25% Democrat, 40% Independent. And so, you know, it always was a tough political battlefield for me. I'm a progressive Democrat. I grew up in a conservative Republican family. I respect and I like conservative Republicans. So, you know, I thought I'd be able to work well with them. And some of them I have been able to work very well with, especially on the House Armed Services Committee. I've had the privilege of being on that committee for 8 years, and we stay very focused on what's important for the nation and what's important for the world. So, you know, when I came in, I expected it to be rough. It was rough for me politically, and it has been rough in Congress. But I do think that, again, you know, we have to look at the people that aren't grabbing the microphones and saying those awful things and realize that there's a body of people there who are trying. They just need more members, or shall I say fewer members, that think that they should just be soloists and they don't really care what anybody else thinks. They are playing, you know, strictly to the people at home, to their base.
Okay. Well, Representative Gutierrez, let me turn to you because you have been serving your district since 1993. And, you know, as you well, you and both Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter know, I think Congress has the lowest approval ratings in America of any branch of government. I mean, how has Washington changed? How have you seen it change since you first took office in 93?
Well, look, it's more partisan today than it's ever been before. It's hard to work across the aisle. Bipartisanship is something that is much applauded, either in editorial comments or by the punditry class in America, but it's seldom rewarded. Having said that, I'm very optimistic about the future of America and the work of my colleagues in the Congress, in the Senate, and in the House. 7 million more people turned out to vote for Democrats this last election. And I think they turned out because, I believe they turned out because they're really sick and tired of the kind of authoritarian stances that the President of the United States has taken. I think we see a coming together of Americans, of broad-based Americans. They see a president that attacks Muslims, and they came out to vote. They see a president that attacks transgender community, and they came out to vote. They see a president who attacks people trying to seek refuge in the United States and asylum in the United States, and they see one that calls Mexicans murderers, and they came out to vote. So guess what? Democracy is working, and I am committed to continuing that work. I have walked up and down the streets of the 4th Congressional District during the last 3 months with my daughter, who's running for the city council, and let me tell you, I have met hundreds of new citizens of the United States. There's a million locked up, obviously, by the Trump administration that have petitions for citizenship, because they want to vote.
Right.
We see people wanting to get organized all over. And lastly, it wasn't a fluke. The Women's March was not a one-time proposition. Women are running, they're winning, and they're changing the landscape of American political system.
Yeah. Well, so Congressman Shea Porter, let me turn back to you here, because just to be frank, I mean, I suppose I'm slightly surprised, but maybe I shouldn't be, that both you and Representative Gutierrez are expressing a degree of optimism, because broadly speaking, I'm not sure the American people feel that way, because, you know, incoming congressmen and women constantly, in cycle after cycle, they campaign on hope, they campaign on change, they campaign on bringing fresh new ideas, and they may be sincere about that as they're campaigning, but then they get into Congress and they're bogged down by having to constantly fundraise, they're bogged down by the lobbying structures in Washington, they're bogged down by, or the American people see nothing but deepening partisanship and not real change here. So is your optimism out of step with the reality of what the American people see in the House of Representatives?
Well, I will tell you that I was and remain a grassroots activist, and so I feel still very close to the population. I ran all of my races without taking any corporate PAC money or D.C. lobbyist money, so I have stayed very close to people, and I know that they were in despair in January of 17. And, you know, we were all deeply concerned, and I remain concerned about the impact that the president has had and the growth of hatred, et cetera, that we witnessed. But I agree with my colleague there that it's the American people that are going to save us. And I think they've already taken giant steps from the very beginning, from that Women's March and from these groups that grew locally and then came together in Washington and other places in states around the country and really are working to reshape this. So I'm very concerned about the money. I mentioned the money is disgusting. I'm concerned about the impact the NRA has. We still haven't done anything on gun safety, which breaks my heart. And we still have a lot of problems with our environment that we've done very little on, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know the list as well as I do. Mm-hmm. But the American people are knocking at the doors of Congress, and they're saying, open up. We want transparency. We want this to be cleaned up. We want to see people that hear us and know us and are willing to be passionate about issues. And if I had to say anything to any new member, I would say this to them. I would say, keep your passion. Remember why you're there. The greatest compliment I've been paid after my 8 years, and I have been involved in this since 2006, my first election, was that I'm the same person that I was when I arrived. And I would urge all new people to stay that and remember why you're there and who you're serving, and that work is what you do, not who you are. So if these new members who have so many great ideas and have inspiration can stay away from the corporate business and stay away from all the things that break down, you know, process, they can do well.
Mm. I've
got the American people ready. Yeah. American people are paying attention. And that was what was missing for so long, that I don't think enough people tuned in because they thought things were working okay, and you know that, and then they started to notice that it really wasn't.
Yeah, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Representative Gutierrez, I just have a simple question for you. I mean, honestly speaking, how much time did you have to spend per week or per month fundraising? Because, I mean, you know, essentially with a 2-year term, congressmen and women essentially feel like they have to be campaigning all the time.
Look, I didn't. I did my campaigning during the 24 months in between elections. So what we did in the 4th Congressional District is we helped 60,000 people become American citizens. Let me just repeat that. Yes, in 26 years, we helped 60,000 people fill out application forms, learn English, the Constitution, and got them through the process of becoming American citizens. Too much time and focus is spent on just the legislative process. It is the process of making government work that is independent of the halls of Congress that I've committed and dedicated myself to. And traveling around the country, people in my congressional district allowed me to do that. because they understood the importance of the civil rights, human rights movement that we have in terms of a broken immigration system.
Yeah.
So we've been able to change that. I just want to say something.
Can I just jump in here for a second, Congressman? I don't mean to cut you off, Congressman, but I just want to clarify something because I'm not sure I heard you correctly, and I want to be sure I did. When I asked about how much time you had to spend on average fundraising, did you say that you didn't at all?
Not a lot.
Okay.
Not a lot. I was fortunate. I always and I'm trying to answer your question. I always saw as fundamental to my work and what I do is just working, right? And so I didn't have to do a lot of work. I'm also very fortunate because while some of my colleagues would sometimes give those sneering, mocking eyes at me when they saw me with Univision or Telemundo, and they looked at them as the ethnic. What they needed to realize was I was actually talking to millions of people, and I was talking to 1/4 of the registered voters on a continuing basis. So I have been communicating, and if you communicate and do your work, especially in a congressional district like mine, then you get reelected. But let me just say this because I want to echo the comment. Here's what I learned in 26 years in Congress. Nothing happens without a demand from the people. We spend too much time on the back rooms and the corridors of Washington, D.C., and what happens there. And what's happening in America today, that on the streets and the neighborhoods and the villages and the counties across this country, people are organizing, and they're going to make sure that our democracy is preserved.
But Congressman Gutierrez, I have to jump in here for a second. Congressman, if I may, please, forgive me for interrupting, but I have to jump in here for a second because I also want to let Congresswoman Shea Porter back in. But when you say people spend too much time focusing on what goes on in the back rooms and back deals in the halls of Congress, but that is where the decisions are made. That's where the deals are made. That's where the laws get passed. Shouldn't we actually, that is where the work gets done on behalf of the American people who put you in office.
I understand that. But I part from the following premise. That nothing happens in Congress without a consistent and persistent demand from people, the American people. And as long as that consistent and persistent demand is there, guess what? You bring a lot of transparency and clarity, and people come out of those back rooms and corridors and do the job of the American people.
Congresswoman Shea Porter, let me let you back in here. What do you think?
Well, you know, there's a saying in Washington that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so for a long time, I would say to all these grassroots activists and the groups that were coming to urge more spending for healthcare or more spending for, you know, various environmental issues, et cetera, that you really needed to come to the Capitol and come to the seat of power and be seen and be heard. Because we have groups that come in every 3 months. And, you know, they have a right. Everybody has a right to come to Congress and meet with their member. But you have some groups, and there are business groups that show up every 3 months, and then you have other groups that never showed up. And so what we have seen, and this is, I think, what my colleague and I are saying, what we have seen is this ignition of energy and concern and that passion. And people are paying attention, and that is what's giving both of us hope that the American people are shining a light on the process, which is the way it's supposed to be. Now I hope that they pay very close attention to that money that we're all talking about, that dark money.
Yeah.
There's a lot of legislation that never got through that needs to be passed so that we know who's trying to pull the levers. And so for the American people really to be seen and really to be heard and have the same influence, we've got to cut the flow of the dark money.
Well, Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter and Congressman Luis Gutierrez, they're both outgoing Democrats from New Hampshire and Illinois, respectively. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.